So, we have a lot that we're going to talk about this evening. We also have some information for you all to collect and take with you, and we also have some buttons that you all can make donations for. There's a great display about one of the occupations the United States is involved in that's up there that was done by Ken Schroeder, because we have to really realize right now that the United States, which is us, are now involved in three occupations. There's an occupation in Afghanistan, which we are directly involved in. There's an occupation in Iraq, which we are directly involved in. There's also an occupation in Palestine, which we pay for. And it's important that we know that. And if you're like me, I've been watching CNN lately, and I'm having trouble keeping my occupation straight in my mind, because I look at these roadblocks, and I can't quite figure out where they are. Is this Ramallah? Or is this Baghdad? All I can recognize is very familiar scenes of cars lined up for miles, soldiers with guns, very often people dragged out of their cars sitting on the side of the roads, sometimes with duct tape over their mouths and their eyes. And these are all starting to look very familiar, I think, to all of us. And the only thing that I know is that whether it's Afghanistan or Baghdad or Ramallah or Gaza City, we're involved. And I think we're going to be able to spend a little time tonight talking about what we have done and what we can do in the future to change all of that. And we're honored tonight to have Kathy Kelly from Voices in the Wilderness, who 2 years ago was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for the work that Voices has done, who when the Gulf War first started, the first go-round in 1991, was a member of the Iraq peace team. That's when I first heard about Kathy myself. And then in 1996, she was one of the founders of Voices in the Wilderness, which has directly challenged the United States-sponsored economic warfare called sanctions against the people of Iraq, and has been fined by the United States government hundreds of thousands of dollars for the work that she has done, and has recently was part of the Iraq peace team and was in Iraq 4 or 5 months throughout the United States invasion and returned right around April 24th, I believe it was. So I think we're going to hear a slightly different perspective from Kathy than we might be seeing on Fox News. So I'd like to welcome, it's my pleasure, and I've been lucky enough to be able to spend a lot of time with Kathy the past couple of days, Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness.
Anywhere over there is fine.
Well, thank you very much to Michael and to all the members of the church here and to familiar faces who've come out a second time to be together. And it's certainly not my first time being in this church, I don't think. So I'm a bit nervous about doing reruns, but I'd like to start off with something that comes dipping back a bit into my past. Maybe the most courageous thing I did in 1991 when the United States went to war against Iraq was to go to 5634 South Normandy, where my mother lived, and tell her what I was about to do. It was a non-starter. My mother had no word of support for me going over to Iraq at that point. I had just gotten out of a year of maximum security prison, and she thought that was enough for a stretch of time. And so it was really kind of a wooden embrace goodbye. I wasn't able to persuade her to support this at all. And she, looking for one last-ditch way to persuade me, said as I went out the door on a blasting cold January afternoon, and the door was about to shut behind me, and then I really was pierced by my mother's voice in her thick Irish accent saying, "What about the incubators? Kathy, what about the incubators?" And some of you would remember that in 1991, when there had been debate about the war, nothing even close to the anti-war movement that was mobilized worldwide this time, but there was debate, and one of the things that swayed the debate in the United States was the appearance of a young Kuwaiti teenager a beautiful young woman. Her name was Nayira. And Nayira appeared before the U.S. Congress to tell them that she had herself been doing volunteer work in a Kuwaiti hospital, and she had witnessed Iraqi soldiers break into the hospital, dump babies out of the incubators, and loot the incubators. And people all across the United States, hearing Nayira's story, which appeared on C-SPAN, I think were easily in agreement with my mother. You've got to do something about people like that. They can't be allowed to continue. After the Gulf War in 1991 was over, some very enterprising journalists went to Kuwait to interview the doctors in the hospital where Nayira had been a volunteer. And the doctors, the Kuwaiti doctors, said, incubators, you want to see money? We have money incubators. We have in storage, we have here. What you want, incubators? And these journalists started to realize that Nayira's story didn't hold water. And as they dug a little more deeply, the New York Times and the TV Guide were in concurrence that Nayira's story was, as they said it, a hoax. That, in fact, she had never left the United States in 1990 or 1991. That she was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States, and that the Kuwaiti embassy had hired the Hill and Knowlton public relations firm to advise the Kuwaitis about how to market or sell the idea of the war. And it was a very, very good package. And it worked. Years later, I was in hospital after hospital in Iraq, traveling over there with the Voices in the Wilderness campaign, trying to alert people about the effects of economic sanctions. And then I saw incubators stacked on top of incubators, useless, broken down. They didn't even make the spare parts for these old incubators anymore. And Dr. Kasail Rahim telling me that he counseled the women, the mothers, to place their babies inside their breasts and wrap a stole or wrap their abaya around them, and maybe in this way they could approximate an incubator when their infants needed such in order to stay alive. And so my mother's question still pertained. What about the incubators? This time, Mr. Andrew Card, a publicist for the Bush Jr. administration, was asked in August why the administration wasn't coming up with a more coherent, convincing sales pitch for a new war. And I was very conscious of that. I was fasting in New York City with a group of people still calling for an end to economic sanctions. We were on day 36 or day 37, and I remember Andrew Card responding, "Oh, everybody knows. You never try to market a new product in August." Roll on September, October, November, December, and 2003, and you know, you have to hand it to them, the people that marketed the new war. They sold it to the American public. The American public was pretty well convinced. You got to do something about weapons of mass destruction. You got to do something about the Al-Qaeda network being linked to Saddam Hussein and Iraq. Well, the war is over. There's no evidence of weapons of mass destruction. Some mobile units have been found, but there aren't any traces of weapons of mass destruction in the units. Still no convincing link that would hold up in a court of law regarding Iraq's government and Al-Qaeda. And what we have now is, well, we had to do it because it made the Iraqi people happy. We got rid of Saddam Hussein. And so it's at that point that maybe I can come in on things with some other points of view that might be useful for some of you in your further dialogues. I want to say, first of all, that one piece of wisdom that most of you, I'm sure, have already known for a long time, but it stands with me, is that where you stand determines what you see. And I believe that most, if not all, of the people in this room have stood together, as Mike mentioned, as people who saw a vision for a way to resolve problems without war. But I just want to remind us all that we're 6% of the world's population, maybe less, and that worldwide there were millions of people standing with you as you resisted this war or questioned this war. And that even though there may be some reason, as we are honest with ourselves, to feel a bit discouraged, it's also, I think, vital that we remember that worldwide, internationally, the critical mass needed to stop a war before it starts was almost reached. We've never come closer than we did this time. You could almost taste it. And that people in Europe are so ready to put war behind them. And people in other continents have many, many other problems that they need to address desperately. They don't want to be sucked into war making that the U.S. government wants to use in order perhaps to create an empire. So I think we do have a tremendous anti-war movement with which to practice stewardship at this moment. May I also, though, take this opportunity to say that we all have seasons. If by any chance any one of you is thinking, I need a breather. I worked hard, now I need to pull back for a while. I think, yeah, take that season, take that break. For those that might be feeling like you want to go full tilt ahead, then I think there's plenty for all of us to do. And my belief is that one of the best ways to try to prevent a next war is to tell the truth as fully as we can about this war. And that's why I and others in Voices in the Wilderness want to recommend Iraq Summer, focus a spotlight on Iraq, and to remember those in the civil rights movement who were amongst the most dispossessed and humiliated people that our history ever saw. And those people in Mississippi Summer, and Michael could tell you more about it sometime, and others who are in this audience, I know, managed through very, very blistering hard work and facing lynchings and facing beatings and facing execution and murder, went to other people in their own area and managed to keep on knocking on doors, making the pitch that brought a whole vast change of opinion about eventually within the United States in terms of fighting segregation and promoting the right to vote. So I do think that we have reason to still remain hopeful. I'd like to say something about shock and awe. And with a group of people, many of whom are faith-based, it sticks in my craw a bit to even use the phrase shock and awe, knowing that the word awe was appropriated by the U.S. military as a descriptive term for destruction and for killing, when really the concept of awe belongs in the province of the sacred, where we show our reverence for that which we most believe to be central and life-giving and holy. So certainly we don't want ourselves, I believe, to genuflect to that notion of shock and awe predicated on what are really the stated and the avowed aims of terrorists anywhere in the world who say they want to achieve a political goal or a goal of social change by inflicting such fear, such terror, that others will be coerced. Well, we would have to hope that that's not going to be the basis for U.S. foreign policy, that the United States won't continue with a go-it-alone strategy based on threat and force. But initially, when the first round of bombing began, quite honestly, many people in Baghdad didn't seem very shocked and awed. We were kind of tittering, saying it's going to take a lot more than that to shock and awe the Baghdadi people who had been through the Iran-Iraq War, the Gulf War, 13 years of economic sanctions that were brutal and punitive, the Desert Fox War, and bombings throughout the no-fly zones for years. So people were still out in the marketplaces. They were driving cars. I think many thought, okay, there's going to be a pounding. It'll be severe. We hope that it's more precise than it was in 1991. And then there will be a squeeze. They anticipated a kind of a siege that would happen. And then eventually, I think many thought the government of Iraq would just leave. Well, that, of course, had to be rethought, because shock and awe did begin to take hold. And pretty soon the streets were empty. And we all got the message that no place was safe. It wasn't safe outside. It wasn't safe inside. It wasn't safe in the morning. It wasn't safe at night, because the United States began to drop the bombs morning, noon, and night in civilian areas, in shopping areas. Homes in rural areas were hit, and even the hotel housing 750 Western journalists was hit. And I would like to just describe the effect of shock and awe from where I was in the Al-Fanar Hotel, a family-owned hotel. The owner of the hotel, a Muslim man, had invited a Christian extended family to stay with us, and also the hotel workers, children and wives, were invited to stay with us. And then we were there from the Iraq Peace Team, and then members of a couple of NGOs, especially the Life for Relief and Development Group. We became a pretty tight community. But within 3 days, I started to notice that the two little girls that I'd grown most close to, Milada and Zainab, Zainab at 1.5 years of age, and Milada, 3 years old, beautiful children, engaging. You know how a little one will run to you, and Zainab was very conveniently just the size that I could pick up easily, and cradle, and Milada, delightful to play with. But I started to notice after the third day of bombing that both of those little girls were constantly grinding their teeth, gnashing their teeth back and forth. And little Milada had a game that she wanted to play over and over and over. I couldn't distract her from it, and I tried. And the game was something like this. She'd shout out the word Tayara, meaning airplane. And then she would imitate an airplane swirling through the skies, and then she would hit herself in the chest and flip backwards on the bed or on the floor or in my arms. And that's how a three-year-old copes, with the notion that the explosion that's making the building sway and the floors shudder and the windows shake, and her mother tries to put on the poker face again, but she knows better than to think she's secure. And that's how a three-year-old copes, with the idea that the Tayara might hit her. And when the lights would go out completely, as happened, I can't remember exactly which day, but we just lost electricity entirely, then her mother would sometimes be kind of groping down the staircase, and I'd come with a flashlight to help. And Milada always wanted to play with the flashlight. And she didn't want to play shadow shows. She didn't have much time for Tinkerbell. She had a purpose with that flashlight. She wanted to first aim it at her mother, and kill her mother, and then aim it at me. And that's how a little girl copes with the idea that her mother or her big new friend might be killed. So yes, shock and awe, I think, did start to set in Baghdad. But there really wasn't much of a time for people to exhale when, in fact, the statue in Ferdows Square was toppled. And then I want to lead into another notion that you might have gotten from the media, which I think perhaps needs to be looked at further. And that is the idea that after the bombing, people were full of jubilation and thanksgiving. There's no doubt that there was a sense of release and relief because the regime of Saddam Hussein was gone. I could discuss that at much greater length, but I think in many ways the mainstream media has probably covered that part of things. However, I myself, within one day after the beginning of the occupation, did not detect the jubilation. I didn't hear much along the lines of thanksgiving. And I think one main reason for that is that it sort of went all around Baghdad, that the occupying forces had sent 12 armored personnel carriers to surround the Ministry of Oil, and they didn't even have a map with the crossroads for where the hospitals were. And so the hospitals turned into war zones. And then the ministries, which had already been bombed, many of them, were completely looted. And what that means is, suppose that you're a doctor in Iraq and you have an idea that someday you'd like to practice outside of Iraq, but the Ministry of Health has been completely looted and burned. How will you ever prove you're a doctor? How do you prove you're a student? How do you prove you exist? How do they ever get trade negotiations reestablished? How can they ever get health certification and health records made available? How are they going to be able to call up the people that were responsible for food distribution when the UNDP and the UNICEF and the World Food Program offices have all been sacked and looted? And even though requests were made to the U.S. military, please, don't let things get so out of hand, there was a passivity, a kind of sit back and watch on the part of Marines who said, we're a fighting force. It's not our job to police. And I wonder now, was the reason because maybe in somebody's scheme of things, there was a desire to have things become so chaotic, so desperate, that Iraqi people would start to say, please, police us, govern us. And other people, humiliating the Iraqis still further, might say, well, those people are ungovernable. You have to rule them with an iron fist. And this is speculation, I don't know. But it was a very, very difficult reality. So that what I heard people saying were lines like, maybe the only thing we've been liberated from is the notion that the United States ever wanted to save us in the first place. Or the mother of those two little girls that I told you about, she sat looking out a full plate glass window from the Alphanar Hotel at the intersection of our hotel and the Palestine, which was now filled with armored personnel carriers, Humvees, tanks, jeeps, bulldozers, all cream-colored, and very well-armed soldiers peeping up out of the hatches. They were so young, you know, they all looked like Gerber baby Jerrys to me. She looked at this full-scale occupation, and she said, never did I think that this would happen to my country. And I am very sad. And I think that this sadness, it will never go away. That would be, as I understood it, a much more honest response. Or that of a doctor from the, now it's called the Al-Sadr neighborhood, formerly the Saddam City neighborhood, a very, very poor area. And he is a doctor who stayed there to work with people in the area. He said, it is as though you have been coming out from under an anesthetic after an operation. The anesthetic wears off and you feel pain and fear and confusion. And you sense that you are waking up from one nightmare, but you're afraid that you might be descending into another. It doesn't sound like jubilation, does it? I also think that it's important for us to keep an eye not only on the footage that you might have seen again and again and again of the statue of Saddam Hussein being toppled at Ferdows Square. And those 200 people, I think, might have been a rent-a-crowd, to be quite honest. I was a block away from there. There's just simply no way that any of us could comprehend that there would have been lots of people coming out into that square of their own accord coming from the neighborhood. Because that morning, looters, they call them Alibaba, were 10 minutes away from where we were at the bridge. People were inside their homes, doors locked, windows shuttered. Trust me. Everybody was nervous about that. Then all of a sudden, this huge occupation comes steaming in, and people didn't know if the tanks were going to get into skirmishes with civilians. They didn't know if they might be arrested. People were definitely indoors. We couldn't have crossed that street any more than we could have flown. That would have been the only way to get over there to watch what might have happened. But anyway, it certainly was a time of release. I want to acknowledge that because Saddam Hussein was gone. But I think the place to keep an eye on more vigilantly would be that city of Karbala, a very holy city, where a million people came together. A million people came together on the heels of intense bombing, chaos, occupation, curfew, no electricity to produce a flyer or an announcement, no telephones to help turn anybody out. You know how hard it is to turn out a big crowd in San Francisco. It's hard work. Well, this is a million people who have gathered together to commemorate religious leaders who died some 14 centuries ago. And of that group of a million people, there probably were many who would subscribe to a practice of Islam similar to that which is practiced in fundamentalist mosques in Iran, where the country is under a theocratic state, and you can just about guess that Mr. Rumsfeld, Mr. Cheney, Mr. Wolfowitz, Mr. Pearl are not going to say, oh, that's very good. That's what we wanted for Iraq, a democracy expressive of a group that might in fact be quite hostile toward U.S. aims. So if the United States wouldn't accept that form of Islam, remember that 60 to 70% of the Iraqi people are Shia, and possibly a fairly large contingent of that number would be sympathetic to the kind of Islam practiced in Iran. Okay, so what would containment mean? Well, if we look to past history of how the United States has contained or neutralized groups, movements that it doesn't want to see, it's involved death squads, paramilitary groups, intelligence operatives that often will use violent means. And it seems to me that people who are thinking so hard in Iraq today might be thinking about those kinds of realities when they say maybe the only thing that's changed is that Saddam Hussein is gone. In other words, they're worried about who might get the upper hand, about what it might mean to go on somebody's list as being anti-US, about whether or not it really is safe to engage in freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. And then they discover that when they just go to a school in Fallujah and say, could we get our school back for classrooms that we'd like to open? Could the U.S. military kindly unoccupy this school? Maybe a shot rang out, a rock flew. I don't know exactly what happened, but the U.S. military response, thinking they were under fire, was to kill 13 people. So when you combine the very immediate evidence that the U.S. wanted to secure its military and economic interests by going right to the oil fields and right to the Ministry of Oil, with the fact that there was very little effort to do anything about garbage pickup, about sewage and sanitation, about clean water, about the kinds of things everyday ordinary people would need, and then some of the skirmishes with the new occupying force, I think we can understand why some people were starting to say what our very dear friend Sattar said when he was stopped at a checkpoint. A U.S. soldier kind of fingered his blue jeans trying to make friends with him. And Sattar had already worked for 13 days in a hospital where he was literally skidding on the floor where the blood was so thick. And he and 12 other fellows were trying to help three Iraqi doctors tend to a nightmare of patients all needing help desperately without enough anesthetic to ease their pain and limbs that were shattered and abdomens ripped open and flesh that was torn. And Sattar, who'd never ever been able to even look at a patient in a hospital when he'd gone with us many times, he's our close friend, our driver, never joined the Ba'ath Party, and a well-trained civil engineer, he began to clean wounds and inject IVs and bandage people up, trying to do his best to help these doctors in one of the poorest hospitals in one of the poorest areas. So he knew what much of the effect of this war had been, both because of driving through Baghdad streets, being in the hospital, and then himself seeing a storage area with 1 to 2 years' worth of food looted as a United States Army official with a Kuwaiti accent had directed a tank to blow off the front doors of the food storage. As he told me all these stories, it made sense to me then that this man who epitomizes nonviolence and hospitality and caring and simplicity said to the U.S. soldier who was trying to make friends with him by fingering his blue jeans, when the U.S. soldier said, blue jeans, good, America, Sattar said, yes, but these blue jeans were made in China and not in America. And the soldier said, are you glad that we're here? And Sattar said, no. And at this point, his eyes welled up with tears and he began to cry. He said, I wish that I could have killed before you came here to destroy our families and our homes and our big home. And by that, he meant Baghdad. And then the soldier said, I could shoot you now. And Sattar's brother, a giant of a guy, Ali, said to Sattar, What are you doing? Are you crazy? You could get us killed. And Sitara said to him, that's right, to the soldier. You could do this now, and no one could stop you. But what will you do in 3 months? You cannot even keep us from killing each other. And what if the people turn on you? And I feel sure that he wasn't recounting this to me, nor had he said it to that soldier with a spirit of venom or a spirit of hatred. He was being descriptive. And so when we hear that Iraqis experienced the United States occupation with jubilation and thanksgiving, I have to say that that doesn't corroborate with my own experience, nor do I think we'll see much more of that in the weeks to come, in the weeks that are ahead. I'd like to just make one set of comments about looting. It was hard to watch billows of smoke in building after building after building in central Baghdad, where terrible, mindless, wanton destruction was going on. So I wanted to think about what was happening there. One conclusion I reached, which I say in a kind of confessional way, is that I know a lot more about mindless, wanton destruction than I usually care to admit. Because every morning when I get out of bed, I start. I'm on my way, consuming electricity, natural gas. I don't know anybody who guzzles more gas than I do going back and forth to places on airplanes. I don't even know how to drive a car. That's the one thing the Kelly family all agreed to, but I guzzle plenty. One consensus. I guzzle plenty of gas. And, we live a lifestyle that consumes, really, by some estimates, 35 to 50% of the world's resources, just being 6% of the world's population. And it is kind of mindless. And it's wanton. Mother Earth, the planet can't sustain us, according to the World Watch Institute, for more than 2 more generations unless we radically change our lives. And if I go to Chicago, and maybe I'm a little bit less abstract about things, I know that because I live in a lifestyle that's comfortable and has always been comfortable, and I don't always care very much about people a couple of neighborhoods away from me who've always lived in abject poverty, that if the authority system in Chicago ever came unglued, the social volcano ever erupted, as it could, as it did in Baghdad, but as it could in Chicago, Chicago's Magnificent Mile would be a shambles. So what happened over in Iraq, I suppose, is not as far away from us as we might think. And also when it comes to looting and thievery, I think the greatest instances of looting and thievery will be happening at the hands of Bechtel, Kellogg Brown and Root, the corporations that are going to have the contracts to control Iraqi oil wealth. Now, I hope I'm proved wrong. I greatly hope I'm proved wrong. But it could well be that as the United States and other coalition forces start to control Iraq's oil wealth, it won't go to meet the needs of Iraqi people. But yes, that looting was very, very hard to see. And if I was saddened about it, imagine Iraqis who did have so much to lose. I'm thinking of the more affluent people, the more educated classes. This was very, very hard for them. I have a friend named Hisham al-Sharaf, and he has taught all his adult life at the school that he attended, which is the Baghdad School of Folk Music and Ballet. It's a wonderful place, wonderful instruments, a capacity to teach kids Western classical music and Oriental classical music. They even have one of the only pianos of its kind that has the 2 keyboards in one piece of furniture. And they're so proud of that school, of their students, of their past. And the teachers are mainly the people who then, of the men anyway, well, some women, form the Iraq National Orchestra as well. So this has been a place that I was often very pleased to go to. This was 2001, 2002, with kids in a cancer ward. And you know that none of them are going to survive. Iraq's cure rate for cancer has been 0% since the economic sanctions were imposed. And several that I'd grown very close to had died, particularly one little guy named Muntadar. His name means waiting for. And while in the ward, we had distributed little tiny plastic harmonicas to kids on the ward. But the first day I saw Mother there, he was too sick to give him anything, and he was in a lot of pain, and he just had his spleen removed. And so I kind of tiptoed past his bed. But as I got to know him better, I was sort of proud, because I went in there one day, and his mother said he'd been asking for me every day. Where is Kathy? Where is Kathy? And he reached up and gave me a big hug when he saw me. And then he whispered in his mother's ear, "Does she have a harmonica for me?" So he had noticed that first day that he'd been somewhat skipped with that. So I dug down in the pockets of the jacket, and I was so relieved. I had one little tiny plastic harmonica in the pocket of that jacket, purely by chance. Gave him the harmonica, and he was just as happy as could be. Couple more visits, coloring books, games to play. Easily an enchanting child and easy to distract from his sickness and pain. But then on about the sixth visit, I walked in and the sheets were turned back on an empty bed. Muntadhar had died January 5th, 2001. That's 2002. His name means waiting for. And I thought to myself, you know, if that child had been able to live with his, you know, beaming eyes and his joy in that little tiny piece of plastic as a harmonica, he might have grown up to be a great musician. He might have grown up to be in the Baghdad Symphony Orchestra. And every single one of those little lives lost to their parents who loved them so much, every one of those 500,000 children under age five who died under economic sanctions were lost to all of us. All precious. All beautiful. So I was feeling pretty down, pounding the pillow, and I said, I better go see a different, you know, scene. So they took me to the Baghdad School of Folk Music and Ballet, and there's grass out in front of it, which you next to never see, and children were literally cavorting. They were so happy, these kids, and very proud of what they were achieving, and very, very healthy. Lovely time. I was walking through a hallway, and I saw one of their art exhibits in a doorway, and I was admiring it, and then I just clutched. And I saw a child's drawing in pastel, magic marker, and chalk that showed the Twin Towers and a jumbo passenger jet flying into the left-hand tower. And I thought, did that child draw that picture thinking bullseye? And so I asked the kids, do you think I could talk to your friend who drew that picture? And then they were like their own little Secret Service Mohabarat, you know. Within 10 minutes, they had this kid in front of me. And his name was Al Hussein. And he was just puffed up like a peacock. He was so proud that the foreigner wanted to see his picture. So I asked him, Al Hussein, could you tell me what was on your mind when you drew that picture? And he folded his hands, and he made a little speech. He said, Allah wanted that to happen to people in America, so people in America understand what happens to other people when America hits them. And then his teacher had come over toward us, and he caught her eye, and he said, and we love the people in America, and we want to be their friend. Goodbye, heart. He was just an adorable kid. So I talked to him and his friends a little more. I told them that I'd been in New York on September 11th. Told them that some people felt so strongly that their grief was not a cry for war, that they had walked from Washington, D.C. to New York City carrying that banner, and some of them had lost their loved ones and still wanted to carry that idea forward. And then I don't know why I got into this, because it didn't make it easy on a translator, but I wanted these kids to know that in 150 of the memorial services in New York City following September 11th, families and friends had chosen a song that's a peace anthem, very, very important to both the faith-based and the peace nonviolence community in the United States and Europe, called O Finlandia, or This Is My Song. And that's a song that was initially composed, the melody, by Jean Sibelius. An American actually wrote the lyrics, but it became popular by distribution amongst many, many churches and people after World War I who were hoping there wouldn't be a World War II celebrated these lyrics because The lyrics spoke of the common dreams and hopes, the common aspirations of people. So I was waxing eloquent on this, and the interpreter was trying to translate, and the kids interrupted, and they said, "Yes, madame, why you not teach us this song?" I thought, well, and then I was quickly trying to back out. I thought, what if I started? Because my Arabic is horrible and my voice is much better. And I didn't understand that Hisham al-Sharaf, the head of the school and the head of the Baghdad Symphony Orchestra, doesn't understand the meaning of the word, "I can't." It just doesn't, it's not there. So he said the inevitable mumushkala, no problem. And next thing I knew, they had me in a small room, and the person from the foreign ministry, the piano teacher and Hisham al-Sharaf were poring over the words to this song and transliterating it into Arabic and plinking it out on the piano as I kept trying to sing each line over and over again. And 2 days later, the kids from several of the grades, with violin accompaniment, were singing this song to us. It was amazing. I mean, I thought, well, okay, if this is the last day of my life, no complaints. And there was a price tag. They had asked me to please try to sing this song to audiences that I might be with or groups I might be with in the United States. So I have quite faithfully gone all through the United States singing this song in Arabic. So when Hisham al-Sharaf came to the Al-Funar Hotel to tell me that their school had been completely ransacked and destroyed, that they'd tried, even in a scuffle with the armed intruders, to beg. And this is after they begged the military to please try to save the school, just send one vehicle or a couple of soldiers. And they've been told no, they were told to go away, they were told they didn't have permission to be there talking to the soldiers. So they went themselves to stand in front of the school, and the people that came to loot had Kalashnikov guns and they had nothing. So they said, "We'll give you the instruments, we'll give you the furniture. Just please don't destroy our records, don't destroy the sheet music, don't destroy the history. Leave us something." And those doing the looting, I really want to try to understand this. I think nobody had laid claim to their cares and concerns for years and years and years, and so they weren't going to lay too much claim to the cares and concerns of Hisham and Majid and his brother and the people from that school. And they said, "La, la, 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 Baghdad is finished. And the school is finished." Ransacked, destroyed, broken glass, broken furniture, broken instruments, sheet music burned. Hisham al-Sharaf took me up to the fifth floor of the Al-Funar Hotel, where the Norwegian Church Aid people have an office, and somehow they've always kept a kind of a little media outfit going. And so they put headphones over my ears and said, "Listen to this, Kathy." And I listened, and what they had bought me was a tape of the children on their, with their orchestra, woodwinds and string instruments, playing that song. And I just sort of, unconsciously, I think, began to sing a couple of bars. And then I saw Hisham, and I stopped, because big tears were rolling down his face. And I thought, well, I won't be singing O Finlandia with audiences again. How bizarre to sing these lines about common dreams and common aspirations. I can't talk about that with these folks again. Before I left Baghdad, Hisham and Majid came over one more time. They came over to tell me that they go ahead with their spring concert and they'll sing that song. So I feel, how can I dare not have hope? And even though without a microphone, this may go worse than I can imagine, but I don't dare not sing this song, so I'm going to give it a try. We have with us an Iraqi friend who will testify that it may not make a word of sense to you. My Arabic is that poor, but please indulge me. Ilahi laka neshidi neshidu salam لبلادهم وبلادي هذا وطني أخلادي في فؤادي هنا أحلامي ومقدساتي لكن قلوب أخرى I bila bi pokra, tam budu bi, ak lamin bi sutkin mitli, ya ilahi, avasma neshidi, neshidu salam, ni biladihim wa biladi. So my friends, knowing that Hisham and Majid and their students are going ahead with their spring concert, knowing that my friend Raad, a professor and engineer, assigned to his students the project to build bridges out of spaghetti noodles and pieces of cardboard and paper before the war, so that his engineering students would better understand tensions and stresses and details involved in building a bridge, and then said after the war, by going to poor neighborhoods and reaching his students and even announcing over a radio station that their projects were still due April 24th, because he felt that now more than ever his students needed to understand tensions and stresses and details as they tried to move toward a post-war Iraq. Knowing that we have ourselves so much to learn from Iraqi people and their civilization and their capacity to endure under a regime that was very, very wrongful, and knowing that I myself still can't come back and tell you stories about why Iraqis hate us so much, I'm still asking myself, why do they love us so much? Mm-hmm. I know that the sextant for me, the plumb line, the marker, is going to be a very, very patriotic line, one that goes back to a true patriot from this country. And I invite all of us to explore it in our own ways. Tom Paine, my country is the world. My religion is to do good. Thank you very much. I think that some of you may be familiar with the Christian Peacemaker team. They had a wonderful presence there throughout the build-up to the war and during the war. And I greatly hope you'll stay in touch with all of those fine people, particularly from the Church of the Brethren. We call him the Pope of the Church of the Brethren in my circles, but Cliff Kindy, and regularly a presence sent back very fine writing. But that continues. The Christian Peacemaker team remains not only in Colombia and Hebron and in Native American Indian reservations in the north of the United States and Canada, but also in Baghdad. And the people that are there are taking some very brave steps by staying, because it's quite unsafe. You know, if you're out in a car, you don't know if you might get stopped and looted. If you're just sitting inside of where you live, you don't know if somebody might break in. Trying to go to places where there should be a monitoring presence is quite difficult. And I was so grateful to young Lisa Martins, who went down to Basra, not knowing whether or not it would be safe, because she wanted to find out how our friends in the poorest neighborhood in Basra had fared. So I really want to say a good word of thanksgiving, real thanksgiving, for the Christian Peacemaker team, as well as for the Iraq peace team that persists. We have Ramzi Kaisia, having knocked himself out to create with some young university students a newspaper, and newspapers are a good idea. Quiva Butterly, regularly writing very good articles. Michael Birmingham, doing a lot of the liaison work with other NGOs and other people from Europe, and we'll send more to join them. We have a website, www.electronicirock.net. You just spell that right out, electronicirock.net. And that would be another way to stay updated. But I think here, through Michael and the Peace Center, and I also want to point out Norma, who's part of the Peace Center, and I think it's probably high time that, along with keeping a spotlight focused on Iraq, we start to form those study teams so we can learn more about Iran. And here's the good starting point with her daughter, Sharona, in back. I think we need to learn more about Korea, North and South. I guess we should pay close attention also to Syria, and then again trying to explore the almost unbearable double standards that persist, attentiveness to the West Bank. I saw Rachel Corrie's picture for the first time today. I knew the story, but because we've been without electricity, I'd never actually seen her. And Barbara had this picture. And so I think, you know, as we hold out the hope that there can be unarmed resistance to that which is violent and destructive, that would demolish other people's hopes and dreams, here is a young woman who sacrificed her life, I can guarantee you, I was with the ISM in the Jenin camp in April of 2002. When you go over there, any place you go is really courting danger. So I can guarantee it wasn't a particular setup. And here is a particularly brave young woman. So thank you, Barbara.
A videotape of her memorial service, Barbara says, exists also.
It would be a real privilege for me to hear any of your observations, ideas, questions, guidance for the future. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum.
Peace be upon
everybody. I want to add something to what brave lady here told us about the experience in Baghdad. I've been graduated in Baghdad in 1974. Saddam wasn't there. I spent 4 years in the college and 2 years in the very south area of Iraq. And I learned there that Baghdad was a city built like 1400 years ago. It's not Babylon, it's not Tur. 6,000 years old. It is 1400 years old. And when Abu Ja'far Mansur built the city, maybe you can't know the story about Baghdad from CNN or ABC or CBS. That leader decided to build the city on the middle of Iraq, to be about the same distance from the south and north. So he wrote his engineers and he said, guys, I want the dislocation in Iraq to be complete and to be in the middle of the country as well. And those scientists or engineers, they sit together and they keep thinking. And they decide at the end to bring, to cut, or to kill 4 lambs. And they put 4 lambs, hang them in different locations in that area. Like 1 day of the distance that the horse or the guy who rides the horse, it's about 50 miles maybe or 60 miles apart from each other. And he lived those lambs for 1 week. And they went to the most rotten place of those lambs, then they exploded. And they got the other side and the third side, then they got the best fresh meat, still good. And they chose this place to be the location of Baghdad. And they built the city over there. Baghdad is, most of Baghdad is one flat, it's not. My friend here, she knows, except the very commercial areas with 4 or 5 or 3 floors in it. But most of the city is 1 floor. And the very healthiest spot of Iraq. This I want to mention about the history of Baghdad. There's one more thing. Kirkuk, which is about 50 miles north of Baghdad, the first oil area being discovered in the history of Iraq. There was a pipe between that Kirkuk and that oil fields to the Mediterranean Sea. And that pipe goes to Haifa. Haifa is in Palestine, the Holy Land. My dad worked there for 2 years. He was a policeman. And when he passed away last year, he asked me to visit that city. I couldn't because I'm Palestinian. I can't go to Palestine because I'm guilty to be a Palestinian. It's a problem.
Now the new plan between our government, our big government in Washington, and Sharon is to have that oil of Iraq go to Haifa. And this is the target number one, is to give that oil to the American companies through their pipe. So Israel will benefit from each barrel of oil go to be exported outside the Iraq. That's one thing. There's one more thing. Maybe my friend shouldn't connect between Israel, what's going on in Israel now, and what happened to Iraq. Anybody of you maybe look at the flag of Israel. The flag has David's star with two blue lines, the top and the bottom. This is Nile River and Euphrates River. This is what is the Zionist map for Israel. Next maybe 100 years, next 200 years, we don't come. But the plan is going on now. It's not my explanation for these two red or blue lines. It's mentioned in the Knesset at the stage. On the wall it says, border of Israel is between Nile and Euphrates. Everybody should know that. First step, to have Iraq part of American control areas. And if it's under American control areas, then it's going to be the market for the most developed country in the Middle East, which is Israel. So the first step, Iraq going to be the market for Israeli products. West Bank and Gaza are going to be the resource for the cheap labor. And that's what they want the West Bank to be. No roadmap, it's all false. They will not do anything about peace in there more than having the Palestinians to be the resource of cheap labor. And Iraq and other countries should be the market for Israeli products. That's the second point. My third point is, if we have a great witness for what we did, for what our government did in Iraq, how many witnesses, how many brave witnesses we need in West Bank and Afghanistan and everywhere else to tell us how much our government is so bad, is so ruining the other people's lives. And when we ask why they hate us, we should know they don't hate us. They hold our government. They hate our foreign policy. And we should be careful. We shouldn't listen too much to the brainwashing in our media. We should be careful about what's going on. And we just, you know, praise our friend for her courage and her braveness for her job. And thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that one of the responsibilities we have, you know, keep in mind, realtors say location, location, location. We have to say education, 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 and keep trying to, of course, educate ourselves, but also accomplish that outreach. And you know, as we speak about a war that I think was illegal, immoral, unjustified, completely unnecessary, we should also speak about it as counterproductive. And it may be that at that level, you know, with the warning, you know, that this is counterproductive, that other people in other parts of the world are watching us and are not going to want to submit themselves to a U.S. hyperpower and are rapidly losing complete patience with Israel's double standard, that is the expected double standard, with Israel having 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons. Talk about weapons of mass destruction. Depleted uranium scattered all across Iraq now, possibly 900 tons this time around. And that yet the U.S. having postured that Iraq had sufficient weapons of mass destruction, not even asking the question whether or not they could have ever or would have ever aimed them at us. And, you know, what was the purpose? What was the intent for going forward with this war? And not only is there now the question of oil, and that pipeline, it's done. It's hooked up. But there's also the question of water. You know, we're at the sad point of perhaps needing to make slogans that say, no blood for water. But that's going to be possibly where next wars would be fought, as I drink water from a petroleum-based container. Thank you.
Yeah, I have many questions because our coverage was so skewed and inadequate. It's hard to imagine that anyone survived from what we saw on TV of the Moab on the bunker busters or any building, but I gather that quite a few people did survive, and there's still a lot of buildings standing. Now we look back at the Gulf War, and the estimates are, I think, 200,000 Iraqis killed in the war, and maybe 1.5 million since in the sanctions. Do you have any notion of how many people were killed in the shock and awe and in the war, per se? And second question, do you think the looters might have been rented, like your demonstrators were also rented? In other words, following the script.
Two good questions. The London Independent, about 2 weeks ago, did an enlarged chart. They said approximately 10,000 dead amongst Iraqi soldiers. And I want to mention a lot of those soldiers were unwilling conscripts who never wanted to be part of anybody's army but didn't have a whole lot of choice. And then they suggested 2,500 to 2,700 civilians, and they ended it up with several other lists about the cost of the war and destruction. And then at the very end, in large letters, they had WMD and the equal sign, and then zero. I want to remember that 47,000 children died after the Gulf War in the immediate months following that war. And I think they should have been counted as casualties, and maybe in the statistics you gave, they were. But with no garbage pickup, it was sewage and sanitation not happening at all adequate to the need. With the temperatures rising, I mean, the summer I spent in Basra, it was 140 degrees. And the electricity was out 14 hours a day. So, and no kids were getting anything more than lentils and rice and lentils, and maybe occasionally an onion and, bread, sometimes a tomato, sometimes eggplant. So it's not a very good situation right now because there isn't even the lentil and rice distribution effectively available following the end of May. And so I think that there could be a lot of casualties that will come in the wake of the war, given that, as far as I can tell, the electricity is still very, very sporadic in Baghdad and not existent, not turned on yet in many of the more rural and remote areas, and that the garbage pickup still isn't happening. Carol Bellamy held a press conference today in which she stated very clearly, as head of UNICEF, that a humanitarian catastrophe is looming. And I'll be very interested to see what kind of press coverage that press conference gets, because when she held a press conference in August of 1999 to announce that according to the UN assessment, there were 500,000 children who had died directly as a result of the economic sanctions, you could do a LexisNexis search for all of the media coverage that was directed at that announcement in 1999, and what it amounted to was one half of one sentence in the Wall Street Journal. That's all the coverage that the announcement of 500,000 children under age 5 perishing because of a UN-enacted policy ever got. So we must pay attention to the numbers of casualties. It was a travesty that Mr. Colin Powell said at the end of the Gulf War, when asked how many deaths do you think there were amongst Iraqis, he said, well, frankly, that's not a number that interests me. I think we have to make sure that numbers interest us when it comes to the beloved lives of real people who never meant us any harm, who've been sacrificed once again to an altar of, I think, what will amount to the desire for U.S. greed and control. So maybe we should be grateful, we should be grateful, that the bombs were more precise this time. 80% of the bombs in the first Gulf War missed their intended target. The 20% that hit wiped out the electrical grid and much of the infrastructure all throughout the country. This time, I think the United States didn't want to wipe out the infrastructure because under occupation, the United States will want much of that infrastructure. And as things go, the telephone system has been looted now, the Central Telephone Communications Center just last week, so it'll be a long time before phones will be up and running. But maybe some cell phone companies think that's great. Some of the water treatment places have also been looted, and this is going to cause tremendous problems. And then in terms of like the electrical infrastructure, you didn't really need to loot it to require that the whole thing be rebuilt because it was already so cannibalized with these wizards of engineers, electrical engineers, trying to keep that electrical infrastructure going. But they had to put, you know, we're not being able to import spare parts, they had to take a part from this one that was running and that one that was functioning and cobble it together. So that's all going to have to be redone. Yes, many buildings were left standing. Among them were the buildings on either side of the street of a wide boulevard where a cluster bomb blew out horizontally. And it wasn't intended to destroy the buildings. The buildings were blackened and the windows were broken and, you know, some of the porches were badly damaged. But those kinds of anti-personnel weapons are intended to destroy people. And 13 vehicles were charred and crunched and demolished, overturned. And I had gone and seen that immediately after it happened. So I did see that with my own eyes. We don't know the amount of depleted uranium that might have been dumped on Iraq this time. Scientists are saying about 300 tons of radioactive depleted uranium, a horrid weapon of mass destruction, causative of a five-fold rise in cancers amongst Iraqi children and of many, many congenital deformities, particularly in certain areas where epidemiologists said that the depleted uranium bombs hit, for instance, an electrical facility and caused a tremendous aerosolization of these particles. And anyway, they say 900 tons might have been dropped this time. That's a lot of poison, a lot of radioactive poison. So how many deaths would be attributed to that in the future? It's hard to know. Cleaning up the unexploded ordnance will certainly cost more lives. Cluster bombs that are littered in the ground, landmines that are planted in the ground. And also, as we talk about the enormous amounts of money that were spent on this war, that will be spent cleaning up after this war, that's funding that was desperately needed in Africa. It's desperately needed here in poor communities in the United States. It's desperately needed to fight and combat situations that could be cured. And so I don't even know where you begin calculating the loss after a war. It's always a defeat as soon as it starts. It's a defeat of human ingenuity, of human talent, and of the best that's in us. There's no such thing as a healthy victor of war. We've got to diagnose the illness of victors and then believe it's curable. But it's a sickness, and it's a sickness predicated on the roots of war, and those roots go into our own lifestyles and the violence that I take for granted in my own lifestyle. I confess, and I want to change. But I think the very notion that you could be a victor in a war is such an oxymoron for our time. But we've got to diagnose that sickness and believe that it can be cured.
Okay, what you were saying about the conscript forces, it was circulating around the media that that a lot of the Iraqi soldiers, I mean, it was just to demonize the regime. People were saying that the Iraqi soldiers have Iraqi soldier officers behind them with guns, forcing them to fight. And I don't know. I can't be an expert, you know, but I've played a couple computer games, and I've seen a couple movies, and I've read a couple books about war. But somehow I just can't picture, you know, Saving Private Ryan with the, storming the beaches of Normandy with people in gunboats forcing our soldiers to fight. You know, I couldn't picture that happening. I really realize that you probably weren't around the combat aspect of the war, but was that true? Where, could there have really been people forcing the Iraqi people to fight? Because it seems like if I was in a platoon or something with, you know, 30 other guys, and then there's another guy behind me saying, you must fight or die, and then there's a bunch of Americans in front of me saying, you must die, who am I going to kill? The one guy behind me, or am I going to try to kill the Americans? You know, what was really going on there? It doesn't seem like that could have been a true thing, you know.
Well, I think one thing that comes to mind from the perspective where I was is that people were utterly bewildered. How could it have been that people would hold off to a certain extent an invading army force in this little tiny village of Umm Qasr, which is in the south of Iraq, for some said close to 15 days, and then in Baghdad, it was all over in actually 2 hours, but you know, not more than 2 days. It seems like, in fact, nobody forced people in Baghdad or soldiers that might have been near Baghdad to fight. In fact, the word that went out was, give up, don't even pull out the weapons. I'm very interested, it's the first time I've heard what you said about soldiers being behind. The conscripts, I think, would probably have not wanted to be there. That I could easily imagine. And I do know of one guy who was told by the Ba'ath Party, your job is to pull out the box of guns and distribute them in the neighborhood when the U.S. comes. And he said he wouldn't do it. And they put his brother in jail. And he was one of the desk managers at the hotel where I met. And Ishmael learned that his brother was in jail, and he just was out of there in moments. And then he went to jail in order to free the brother. And he said that 70 people were killed in the jail by the Ba'ath Party people holding those people. And he was sure that he was next. And then the government crumbled, and his life was spared, and he was restored to us at the Alf in our hotel, and we were very, very relieved and glad to see him. So I could never underestimate the ruthlessness of that government or that military. With that said, I also just want to say for the record that there were also hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bureaucrats and technocrats that are people just like us that weren't ruthless. I mean, the government wasn't all Nazis. Fine with me if they say that nobody that was part of the Ba'ath Party enters into a new government. Maybe they need to say that, because if you take one, you get five more of the relatives come in. But it could be that, you know, if a reporter said that he or she saw that, it might have been the case. But I want to say a little bit more then about the U.S. soldiers, who certainly didn't have a U.S. captain behind them with a gun. But what did get some of those soldiers into the army? I talked to a whole lot of them outside the Al-Fanar Hotel when the occupying forces arrived. And these were pretty amazing conversations. I actually was very, very glad the other night when I had a chance to connect with two other people from the Iraq Peace Team so I could ask them, did that really happen? And April had slides of it, Dr. April Hurley. She said, yes, there's the picture. So here's what it was. The occupying troops came in to this small intersection outside the Al-Fanar Hotel. We had signs that said, courage for peace, not for war, and war equals terror. All right, the second one was kind of blunt, I know. We wanted to be out on the street as the troops came up and just be holding them, but the hotel owners, toward whom we felt deepest affection after all this war, said, could you please not do that? We are a bit nervous that tank might decide to shoot at this hotel. So we, okay, how about on the second floor? Yes, Madame, you are welcome. Okay, so we go upstairs, and we're up on the second floor. The troops are coming in, and we've got these big banners. And the military, probably looking at us, wondered, you know, where is their spaceship? But they called up to us, where are you from? And we called down some of our cities, Chicago, Boston, New York, what are you doing here? Trying to prevent war? Well, are you a Red Sox fan? It was an icebreaker. And, you know, we had some other exchanges, and finally we had just a wall stacked high with six packs of bottled water. And I look at Cynthia Banas, a 72-year-old, very dear grandmother from Verona, New York, and I said, Cynthia, shouldn't we bring them some water? She said, of course, that's the right thing to do. So we hauled six packs of water and went downstairs, and then I ran back in, and I thought, well, this is what Iraqis would do for us, and I got an octagonal box of dates and bought those out, and we were distributing dates and giving out bottles of water, and one guy was reading Heart of Darkness. It was his 13th time reading the book, and he was really pleased to talk about plot and character and theme with me. Oh, this is pretty surreal, but okay. And then the commanding officer came up to us, and he said, don't blame these young men. He said, in the heat of battle, I made some hasty decisions, and it's I who will have sleepless nights because a lot of civilians were killed. But he wasn't the only one who had sleepless nights. And I know, because they would take turns filing in late at night into the hotel and sitting up watching BBC, but really wanting to talk. And here are some of the things that were said. One young man said, I never wanted to join the military, but I couldn't feed my kids and still get some education. And one of my daughters was born with a deformity. She had a sixth finger, and I really needed to get a surgery for her, and I didn't have the money, so I wanted to get myself some self-respect in this world, take care of my family. I joined the Marines. He said, as soon as I can, I'm going to get out. I don't want to kill people. He said that he was glad that he had bought up the soldiers in the rear, because that way he didn't have to kill, but that he was really upset because he saw other soldiers. And when a car had pulled up to a checkpoint and the soldier had said, stop, and he said the driver didn't understand what the soldier said, the soldier nevertheless opened fire, and he said it left an orphan in the back seat. The mother and father both shot dead in the front seat. He said they could have shot the tires. Another soldier came up and said, I do everything I can in my own way to try to stop people from wanting to kill. And I try to tell them war history, and I really try to inform myself. And I try to jam my gun as often as I could, because I don't want to be part of this. Another one came up and said, we really grew to realize quickly that these people are very good people, they're beautiful people, and we didn't want to hurt them, and we hope that somehow what we've done might be able to create something good and something better. But there was one night when we weren't so sure, there were fatigues on the floor, and we didn't know if they were civilians or military, and so we shot everybody, and I hope it never stays up here. And he pointed to his head. Now, why were those young people in the Marines? Why were they part of a fighting force? Did they say to themselves, I'm a man and I want to kill? Or maybe we should perhaps ask about Mr. Bush's request made during the war that anybody who wanted to support the troops help by assisting them with home repair and health care. I mean, doesn't that kind of indicate that a lot of the people that are in the U.S. Army are in there in part because they don't have enough resources or enough advanced education to really take care of creating homes and really care for their children? And is it possible that things have become so perverse that we're going to say to people in our society who need help with home repair and child care that the best way to get it is to volunteer to go and destroy the homes and kill the children of other people in another part of the world where you know absolutely nothing except that they don't mean you any harm? So it's not the case that somebody's got a gun behind a soldier in the Marines that's going forward with a gun to kill, but it is the case that we've done so little to widen out the options for poor kids in the neighborhood where I used to teach. So little to widen out the options that in the class of 50 that I taught, 50 kids in the whole school, an alternative school, three of them were dead at the end of every year. And their options were to be addicted or imprisoned or dead. So it isn't that there's a gun, but we haven't left a lot of options for those who are impoverished, for those who got very much the short end of the stick in our own poorest neighborhoods. And sometimes the only way that a mother can feel proud of her son in some of those very poor areas, as if the son signs up to go and kill the sons and daughters of other people elsewhere in the world. And then she can at least be relieved that maybe he won't be killed by the Harrison gents or the Latin kings. So we have a lot of work to do with assisting the veterans that come home. Many of them, in a sense, unwilling conscripts in that they didn't want to go into a war where they'd actually be in combat killing civilians. They signed up for other reasons. A lot of work to do assisting them, and maybe one hope that we can draw is that some of them will help us with the hard work of counter-recruitment and the hard work of going to the places where the junior ROTC is so prevalent and the hard work of assisting the Hispanic people in our communities and the African Americans in our communities who don't want the military in there recruiting their kids and dangling all of these promises but can't give the kids alternative promises. And those are the kids who deserve an economic stake in our communities here. And again, I'm not so confident that if the United States does loot the oil wealth of Iraq, that any of that looted wealth is going to come back to those communities here. I think it might stop in some pockets along the way. Yeah, David.
What would you recommend? We've discussed what we should put on our signs when we have demonstrations. The need is a short statement. But what would you suggest some of the themes would be to help this process of educating the public?
Thanks, Dan. That's a challenging one because I don't do sound bites too well, as you can see.
No, you don't have to craft the language.
The themes. Well, I think, where are the weapons of mass destruction? Or pointing out that the depleted uranium is a weapon of mass destruction, that the sanctions have been a weapon of mass destruction, that the reasons for going to war in the first place never panned out. Another theme, I think, has to do with terrorism. To somehow point out that the greatest terrorism we all face is what we're doing to our own planet, and yet the smokescreen of terrorism is what's held up before us, I think, to get people to go along with the actions of a hyperpower that, in fact, will be counterproductive and might, in fact, lead us to be targets for people who will feel so much resentment and so much anger. I think themes around confronting or uprooting the roots of war here at home. That has to do with militarism. It has to do with crony capitalism. It has to do with how we educate our children, and it has to do with our own lifestyles. I'm amazed at how often I can go on talking, and I never mention the three-letter word, oil. That's got to figure in there, you know, that Iraq is one of the world's most oil-rich countries, and possibly the most oil-rich once some of these fields are developed and explored. Then I think to examine the question of occupation, to monitor what are the effects of occupation and certainly what happens to the oil wealth as Iraq begins to undergo some development. The United States has said it's going to set up an administrative body to oversee humanitarian assistance that will be supervised by the United States, the IMF, and the World Bank. That's not too encouraging. When you think about structural adjustment programs that have been imposed in the past, does this mean that Iraqis are now going to have to pay for education, pay for health care, pay taxes, and get purchasing power through God knows what, you know, scraping by? There are plenty of hypocrisies to be pointed out. You know, at one point, the United States was imposing hefty fines on people who broke the sanctions. I'm one of them. And now the United States itself might be wanting to break the sanctions. So under international law, is the United States abiding with law and order? The double standard, I think, always has to be addressed. You know, that the United States, the country that has developed, sold, stored, and used more weapons of mass destruction than any other country on Earth is our country. We've shipped over billions of dollars to build up weapons of mass destruction in Israel. And Israel has been an occupying country. It's been abusing human rights of a terribly dispossessed people. And always the United States insists that the United Nations look the other way with regard to Israel, and yet we manipulated the United Nations into becoming the enacting body for child sacrifice, killing 500,000 children. It's a terrible double standard. Yeah, thank you.
What would be the correct way for the international community to deal with these cruel, repressive regimes like Saddam and his Ba'ath Party?
Mm-hmm. I myself now would never advocate economic sanctions. In 1991, as I was on a plane getting ready to go over to the Middle East, and people said, well, what can you do besides war? Sanctions rolled off my tongue like, you know, take an aspirin. And I thought sanctions would be a great idea. I won't go that direction anymore. I think, first of all, it takes time, and we can't expect immediate solutions. I think we should recognize that if any society is going to move toward more democratic governing structures, and now including our own, mm-hmm. there has to be an emphasis on education, decent education, improved education. And in Iraq's case, sanctions totally thwarted that. So I think nations should help build up the education in other countries. You know, send educators, send textbooks, send computers, send materials. Then there has to be a capacity for communication. Help build up the communication systems internationally with the country that you're trying to help bolster so that they can wean themselves away from being at all dependent on the ruthless governing figure, and that they'll know that they've got allies outside their borders. So build up communication. If it means having a ship out on a sea, although there wasn't, Iraq so landlocked, there wasn't much chance for that. But, you know, broadcasting in messages of support, if it means being able to make sure that the telephone systems are working by helping get cellular phones in there, if it means trying to help make underground communication systems available, those are all means that can be used and have been used in the past. And then finally, social services. People will have a much better likelihood to set themselves to the really demanding and dangerous tasks of overthrowing, I hope nonviolently, but overthrowing a dangerous, brutal dictator if they at least can have their social services for food and for medicine and, you know, warm housing when it's cold and cooled off housing when it's brutally hot. You know, that they aren't going to spend all their time trying to find an antibiotic for a child who's dying in their family. If their basic needs are at least somewhat met, then people have more time to direct toward trying to figure out what system of governance is going to work. And so I think that everything the United States did under the Clinton administration was just a very thorough example of exactly what not to do if you seriously want to help people get out from under a dangerous dictator. And economic sanctions are the worst thing, I think, that you can do when those economic sanctions are clearly demonstrated to hit the most vulnerable people in the society, which these hit, because then your middle class is going to say, hey, we might be next, and they'll take off. So Iraq lost its middle class, and without some group that can help move a society towards some measure of prosperity, it's very, very difficult to enact social change. Thank you.
You mentioned depleted uranium and the sanctions. Can you briefly tell us what those are?
The economic sanctions were imposed when Iraq invaded Kuwait in August of 1990. The United Nations said, until Iraq comes back out of Kuwait, no food, no medicine, the most comprehensive state of siege ever imposed in modern history was locked around Iraq. Following the Gulf War, the bar on food and medicine coming in was lifted. Iraq could bring in all the food and medicine it wanted. But the United Nations said, until you prove that you have completely gotten rid of weapons of mass destruction, you can't sell your oil. Well, before the Gulf War, they were dependent on the outside world for 90% of their pharmaceuticals and 70% of their food. So if they can't sell what they have to bring wealth into the country, they can't buy what they need. And so much of the infrastructure was already destroyed that the combination of destroyed infrastructure and no wealth coming in and many products needed, desperately being barred, started the mounting death toll. So sanctions went on and on and on. About 4 years after the Gulf War, people started to realize death rates were on the rise, fivefold rises in childhood cancers, that there were many new congenital deformities being discovered, and that this hadn't been a part of the history of Iraq's medical community before, to examine patients with so many congenital deformities at birth, and that the same thing was happening amongst Gulf War soldiers, amongst the veterans. And so eventually people started to do as much scientific research as they could, and the conclusion is that depleted uranium may be the cause of many illnesses, including deformities and cancers. But there hasn't been anything close to the kind of research needed. I went into an obstetrics and gynecology hospital one day in 1999, and I learned that 4 babies just that day in Baghdad had been born with congenital deformities. And I had a photographer with me, so I said, well, could we take pictures? This is in Baghdad. 4 babies, very badly deformed. I can't even talk about those deformities, actually. Took the pictures. And then I said to the director, who is an obstetrician, and the assistant director, who is a gynecologist, you know, have you got any information you could share with us about where the mothers were when they conceived, or where the fathers had been during the Gulf War, or do they know very much about histories of cancer or congenital deformities in the families? And I was babbling all these questions that I'd heard other reporters asking in a somewhat similar situation in Basra. And finally, the obstetrician said, Madame Kathy, you come. She takes me into a ward, and we walked up to just a random bedside, and she took the prescription and she handed it to me. And you know, that prescription was written on the back of a used candy wrapper. And she said, Madame Kathy, we have not anything to write prescription. We have not paper. We have not pen. Yes, these questions, yes, very good. All should be asked. All should be answered. But now we do as we can. And please, Madame Kathy, when you go back, ask your people, please, end these sanctions. They are killing us. That's what I knew of epidemiological studies about DU that month. Barbara.
I was at a teaching yesterday where we were told that all of the medical records of the servicemen, the U.S. servicemen who served in the first Gulf War, were lost when they were flown from Baghdad. They somehow got lost between Baghdad and Washington.
Wow. I know there are more questions. It's getting to be 10 to 9, so we don't want to keep you here too late if people need to go. I just want to myself say a big thank you to all of you for your attentiveness tonight and for, I'm sure, your ongoing prayer and also the leadership that quite likely this community has represented on many issues, many anti-war issues. So when you hear someone like me fulminating, it isn't because I at all think that you haven't been doing it and doing it and doing it. I'm quite aware that here in this room is probably some of the finest of anti-war effort and peacemaking effort. And it's great to see that it spans generations and hopefully will span California and the United States before too long. So, sir.
I just have a follow-up question. I'm still confused about depleted uranium. Is there a connection with Gulf War I? Where does depleted uranium come into play? And did we drop that on them? And if so, in what form?
Well, depleted uranium is the densest substance known to human beings. And it's a byproduct of the production of either nuclear energy or nuclear weaponry. And nobody quite knew what to do with it. it's extremely radioactive, it's extremely poisonous. And then some scientific thinkers and planners realized, well, one thing that would be quite useful as a byproduct of the nuclear weapon and nuclear energy production would be to take this depleted uranium and coat missiles and shells with the depleted uranium, because it is such a dense material that they say to have a depleted uranium cover shell encounter a tank is like putting a knife through a stick of butter. It just goes right through. And it's an extremely valuable covering for any kind of piercing armor or shells or bullets. So companies like the Gatling gun, for instance, the Warthog plane is the Gatling gun, and the Gatling gun shoots out many, many rounds of bullets, and they're all covered with this depleted uranium. And if it hits a tank, it can go through the tank. They've also used it to cover bases of Navy ships, and sometimes they're used in airplanes, I think, for the ballast. There's a lot that I don't know about it. But anyway, as people began to ask themselves, well, what happens when this depleted uranium then is released when there's an explosion? It doesn't just disappear. And what they say is that it aerosolizes into tiny components, which, if ingested by human beings, might cause a radioactivity inside the lungs of the human beings. There's also speculation that although it's not residual in plant tissue, it could be residual in animal tissue. And so that it could be that products are poisoned, which then become part of the food system. And nobody quite knows, but there's definitely a need to do a great deal of exploration and research and scientific study. But till now, United Nations efforts to begin the kinds of studies that would pass muster in academia have been frustrated and thwarted. And so we've been mainly reliant on some very good people. There's a Navy engineer named Dan Fahey who took on independent investigation along with the military toxics campaign, mostly based in Baraboo, Wisconsin. And now Dr. Helen Caldicott and the Physicians for Social Responsibility are focusing full tilt on the issue of depleted uranium. And there are several epidemiologists from Iraq who have, you know, they've tried their very, very best to get the data that would be needed. But, you know, you had to wait 4 or 5 years to find out what the effects were, because it doesn't cause an instant leukemia. It takes 4 or 5 years. So by 1996, we were starting to hear more of reports about the effects of depleted uranium. And many of the Gulf War veterans had been saying that they were suffering from Gulf War syndrome, and they didn't get. I mean, I went to some of their presentations. I suppose I was thinking, hey, I'm a Gulf War vet too, and I just wanted to testify on behalf of the children that I knew. But I put my own notes aside the first time I went to one of those hearings, because I thought, boy, oh boy, whatever time I have, it's going to be spent telling this panel that they need to listen to these vets that are hobbling up to the microphone, stumbling, weeping in front of them. And doctors and professionals listening were starting to kind of doze off and saying really demeaning things such as, well, Private so-and-so, I guess you might say you had the difficult bad luck of being at the wrong place at the wrong time repeatedly. I mean, I then asked him, did we want to also think that an entire generation of Iraqi children were at the wrong place at the wrong time because they happened to live there? But these vets then started to complain pretty vociferously. So this time, there's much more of an Army and a Marine effort to help the vets upon return cope with post-traumatic stress. But I hope there will also be commensurate ongoing levels of insurance for any health concerns they might have. But the complaint should be that we don't have enough information. There should be more. There's not enough. But do keep your eye on Helen Caldicott, because she doesn't let go.
Yeah, and they did just cut veterans' benefits during the invasion. Mm. And I think it's something like two-thirds or three-quarters of those who served in the first Gulf War were affected by depleted uranium.
And there were 10,000 deaths of the number of vets from that war who've now died since they returned is 10,000. Mike, and then sir?
I think we'll all admit, or you can tell me if I'm wrong, that we're hearing information tonight that we're not going to hear or have heard on CNN or on Fox Network. We will hear it on Indy Media, thanks to Brad Johnson, who's here tonight, but we're not going to hear it on NPR even. So, but I've sort of gotten used to that, because I remember the Gulf of Tonkin, and I don't remember the NBC reporting that that was a lie. And I can even go a step further, and I can remember when I was growing up, I can't remember the Florida Times Union in Jacksonville, Florida, having an article in there that there was going to be a meeting down in St. Augustine, Florida, in a church like this, that was going to include a woman by the name of Ella Baker to talk about what people could do for their rights and for their freedom. It was word of mouth. It was people who had been to a previous meeting and been to a meeting like this who would leave the meeting, and then they would talk to five people about what they heard, as I know you all are going to do tonight. And those five people will talk to five more people. And they'll talk to 15 more people and talk to 20 more people. And then you have a mass movement, because that's exactly how the bravest people I ever met in my life, who are the African-American people of the American South, how they built their movement and how they got their freedom. They didn't wait for the Florida Times Union, for the Charlotte Observer, or the Atlanta Constitution, or for that matter, the New York Times, to report on what they were doing. And the other thing that we also know, you know, I've got this box here in my hand, is that you all may be surprised, but the Ford Foundation does not finance the work of Voices in the Wilderness. Neither does the Rockefeller Foundation. And I was looking real hard at those Bechtel grants that were given out this year, and they give out millions of dollars in grants. And I couldn't find Voices in the Wilderness on it. But I do know that Voices in the Wilderness functions on the basis of voluntary donations from people just like you and me and the other 5, 10, 15, 25 people that we're going to talk about this in the next week. So hopefully before we all leave tonight, one, we can make two commitments. One is to talk to five people about what we've heard and talked about among ourselves tonight. And the other is to help support the work that Voices is doing, so we can continue to bring this kind of information forward and this kind of action forward, because we don't need to rely on those mainstream institutions. Because quite frankly, where I'm concerned, we're the mainstream. If anything Kathy said tonight comes across, we in this room are the mainstream in this world, and they are the reactionaries. So, thank you.
KPFA, who I heard your voice, Kathy, a lot, up in the mountains where we don't even have electricity, but we do get KPFA, and in Modesto, if you don't get it out of Berkeley, you get it out of Fresno, I think. So that is our source of truth, as
what
far
station?
As I'm concerned. KPFA?
What station?
Well, up our way, it's 94.1.
We do not receive KPFA here because there's what blocks KPFA is this wonderful country western station. And what blocks AFCF is this wonderful religious station. But you can't get it on the internet.
So this is the Sheep Ranch Catholic worker represented here. They drove 2.5 miles to come down from Sonora, so thank you very much.
I had a question about Ramsey Clark and the International War Crimes Tribunal and the work that he has been doing. It seemed to me that that was a big, big part of the momentum for the peace movement this time.
This time?
Yes, and his book, The Fire This Time, is one of the finest things I have read in terms of a vision of the international community, what could be done with the United Nations, et cetera. And my question is, how do we help further? You know, what are the steps that we can take that can help further that kind of work, you know, as well as the work that you're doing? And I see the two as very connected.
You know, I'm really glad to hear The Fire This Time mentioned. It's an important book, and we have to make sure it doesn't go out of print. And I think there was a new printing of it And that's really a key book to have in your libraries, Ramsey Clark's The Fire This Time, for the exploration of international coping and the United Nations, and also his chapter on the media from 1991 was superb. Regarding war crimes tribunals, I guess I just want to offer one aside, in a sense. And that is, for me anyway, I don't want myself to be engaged in pointing the finger, whether it's at Eichmann in Jerusalem, or Saddam Hussein, or Slobodan Milosevic, or Bush or Blair, without being willing to say that I'm an accomplice too. I get nervous that with war crimes tribunals, there's a focus that says, here are the bad guys, lock them up, and then the rest of us let ourselves off a little easy. And I think there's a lot of complicity with the criminality of war, because quite often wars are fought because the people that are in power think that the rest of us want so much to keep our life the way it is, and it's often indefensible and kind of unjust because we live so, you know, inordinately comfortably while others are suffering in horrible poverty. And so and because we pay for all these weapons, I haven't paid my taxes since 1980, but most people pay for all these weapons, and so the warmongers, the war promoters, think this is what people want. They want us to subject other people to our will so that we can keep things the way they are. I also think that truth and reconciliation commissions are worth a lot more exploration, and perhaps those are better than having one person in the chair with many, many lawyers trying to evoke testimony. It seems to me that the method of people coming together face to face and being kind of facilitated toward expressing the truth and then trying to have some kind of reconciliation and maybe reparation if as possible, that's a very good model, and it hasn't been perfected yet, but it was used in South Africa, it has been used in Central America, and we should, I hope, keep trying to explore that. It's always the further invention of nonviolence that I think we must try to accomplish. So I'm the anarchist in me isn't so crazy about war crimes tribunals, to be honest. But to try to tell the truth, and Ramsey Clark has been stellar at doing that. And often, he's somebody who is a senior person in our lives, and he has tried very, very hard with regard to Iraq to tell the truth. And he was actually invited by the National Press Club to talk recently, so I think that's encouraging. I also hope we'll get Dennis Halliday and Hans von Schoeneck out on the circuit again. They may be kind of tired of talking, but I'm very, very impressed with the two of them. And they, 34 years of service to the United Nations, even though they quit their jobs, they weren't ready to give up on the United Nations. So let's keep emailing them.
Is Charlie Lipke still alive?
Oh, yes, coming back soon to a neighborhood near you. He didn't want to leave until he had a chance to send a letter, which is up on our website, www.electronicarock.net, but hand-deliver it to the occupying troops. And he couldn't make copies of it because there wasn't any electricity in Baghdad, so he came out to Amman, typed up his letter. He was so frustrated because every time he just about had it typed in Baghdad, the electricity not being on meant he was relying on batteries, and the battery would go down, and the computer would crash, and Charlie's not crazy about machines anyway. So he went clear out to Amman, got his letter, made copies, went back in, distributed, and I think he'll be out for the Vets for Peace conference, right?
He's working on the Veterans for Peace conference. He's going to concentrate on that.
Great.
That's in August. I think it's August 8th through 10th.
Yeah.
Where, in Washington?
No, San Francisco. And main address will be in what was the Veterans Theater, now Herbst Theater, where the UN Charter was first signed. And because it's the same period of time as the commemoration of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, those two things will be the emphasis of that.
Thank you all. Take care now.